I am really honored to be sitting here with you to learn more about the Sohetmek culture. But I want to first talk about the title that we just picked for our show, Slaha'iya.
Slaha'iya had been telling the true story, and this is what it's all about. Because we were never a written history, the very little written history on our people. It was all by stories handed down. And this is what is called Slaha'iya. These stories were handed down through the generations of the history of our people. It's almost similar to Chiptekwala. Chiptekwala is the creation stories, the animals and the people around in the Swepmukulu. They were the first ones here. And so I think our people learned from them how to survive in this land. It's like the early settlers, when they moved here, they learned from us how to survive in this land. So that's where Slaha'iya comes from, because there was no written history of our people for centuries. It was only until James Tate and a few others that came to this land and they started the early recordings and written history of our people. And so that's what Slaha'iya means, telling the true story of the Swepmukulu.
And so you've said the word Sohetmek a few times, and I'd like to know, what does Sohetmek mean?
Well, that is one thing that we talked about for a long time. You know, we couldn't figure out, there's no word in our language that refers to Shuswap, unless they swap Chews. But the closest we ever came to, I think it's the Tanakhka band named us. And it means half-naked people, because that's the only time they seen was just during the summer months, because we all went into pit houses during the winter and nobody's ever seen us. And only in the spring and summertime that we roamed around and we were half-naked people. It's the only one that made sense to me and my mother when we talked about it. So it's usually other bands that name you, I think, and so that's where Shuswap came from.
Oh, that's great. And so we've also said Sohetmek Uluh. So what does the Uluh mean at the end?
It means land of the Shuswap.
Right, so land of the Sohetmek people, right?
Well, I was thinking of changing it to Kanak Uluh when hockey season comes on.
I've heard that one before. You are a Canucks fan.
Yeah.
So I've also heard Sohetmek Chin. What does Sohetmek Chin mean?
Speaking in the Sohetmek tongue.
So the T-S-I-N, Chin, means language.
Yeah. At least I believe so. I'm not too familiar with the written. It looks like all French or whatever language I can't speak.
Well, the alphabet used is the Kuiper alphabet, which is very much based on English alphabet, except for a few symbols, like the number 7, which is sometimes used in Sohetmek written language.
I'm still talking French to me. No, I think I learned the language from my grandmother, because I look back at my past and I never realized I could speak the language until about 10, 15 years ago. And I started putting 1-2 words together. Next thing, a lot of words start coming back to me. And being Eskaluta at Sohetmek Chin. And I thought, Chakayam is Eskaluta Chutwa, which was a phrase I always learned with Phil. Always telling lies. Because I start off sometimes talking and I ask the people if anybody could understand Shuswap, and nobody puts up their hand. So I just say, well, I'm going to say whatever I want.
You can make up anything.
Yeah. But then I call it astute, and we're not supposed to really tell lies. You know, we're supposed to be honest and open people, and it's just a phrase that sometimes...
Just like making stuff up as you go.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about the area, the neighborhood, or the community of Switzmalf?
Well, we never wintered here. It's like where we're at right now, it's all bottomland. And during the winter months, you can't build a pit house in there because you end up in the springtime with a big pool in your house.
The indoor pool.
Indoor swimming pool. But normally, I think the closest wintering is over at Sunnybrae and at the bay there. That's where a lot of the pit houses were. And then they were scattered all over up and down the Thompson. There's even some up at White Lake and up and down the Narrows at Shuswap Lake. And yeah, during the winter months, that's where our people stayed all winter long. And so the only time they seen us show up, half-naked people, was during the spring and summer months when we went out hunting and gathering.
And how far into the areas around here that, did you do that?
Well, our people roamed always to Alberta.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they, there's even evidence of pit houses over there because the Prairie people were never in pit houses. And I was invited up to Banff by Peter Poole because he's interested in Native culture. And they have pit houses up there in Banff. So that's why he invited me up there to view them and talk about it. Because I'm kind of a guru on pit houses. I built a few of them because I wanted to experience what it's like to, you know, it's easy to learn from books and talk about it, but I wanted to try it the way, well, experience what our people went through when they built these buildings. You know, that way I have a better feel for it. You know, the sweat, the blood, sweat, and tears they went through when they built all the outdoor stuff. And so that was why I've been building them, trying different things. Right now I'm currently trying to relearn how to tan hides again. So there's a lot of our history disappearing, and I think their assimilation program is working really good, you know. We're slowly losing our ways, and it's kind of difficult, you know, to make people understand what I'm talking about now. Because when I started tanning hides, everybody didn't like the smell of tanning hides right away. And I said, well, that's all part of being a Suwapmuk, you know, to stand the smell and stand the sweat and the tears that go with it. So even a lot of our people can't stand the smell of it anymore, you know. So it's a slow growing process of relearning our culture because there's so many gaps in it, you know. There's some things I might have learned from my grandmother when they took me in. And and I think that it's starting to come back, like the language, you know, what she taught me a long time ago, you know, and the language is similar to it. There's sometimes I instinctively know what's right and wrong with the culture itself.
Mm-hmm. You know. And your grandparents, so I remember you telling me the story of you going to live with your grandparents. Was that normal, kind of the family, where everybody went and where the kids lived and who the kids learned from?
No, it's part of our culture was the eldest sons were given to the grandparents. My older brother was given to my dad's side of the family, and I was given to my mother's side of the family because I'm the second oldest son. And my oldest brother, the grandparents raised him as their own. And he was mad at my mother for the longest time. He thought that she didn't love him until he realized it was part of the culture that the way it was for centuries, the eldest son. I think it was for somebody to look after them when they got too old to hunt and gather anymore. And I was fortunate enough with my mother's side of the family, my grandparents, they were more compassionate. They let me go back and forth. So, and I look back at it now, you know, I really appreciate my grandparents now. And I think that it was the way of our life a long time ago to get that close connection, because they are our teachers, our mentors, growing up. And she must have been teaching me, they must have been teaching me some things when I was growing up. So it was, now the appreciation is there for understanding why it was done. It's that connection with each other. Because we were all the family units back in the day. Everybody helped one another. You know, it was more real democratic society, I think.
And the language that she would have spoken to you is in your brain, right? It's in
it
there.
It must have been. I tried talking it before, a few of the elders there, and I couldn't even, you know, I stumbled through it. But now after, without even thinking about it, now sometimes words will pop into my head without even thinking about it. Sprannie, I was going up to Invermere to visit. All of a sudden, Sprannie hit me. I'm going to visit. You know, there are certain words that'll hit me all of a sudden without even thinking about it. Especially 2 o'clock in the morning.
When you're trying to sleep. Okay, so back to Switzmalf. Can you tell us about what Switzmalf means?
Switzmalf means the Supilali bush. Our people gathered that during the, I think it's one of the first crops that were harvested. And this valley here in Salmon Arm here was really known for its Supilali, the what they call Indian ice cream now. And it's a foam berry. And people harvest that here. I think the majority of the Suwapmuk people came over here, and this whole valley was just covered with Supilali bushes. And so it became known as Switzmalf, the berry bush itself.
And so other bands members would come here to harvest the Supilali?
Yeah, most of the Suwapmuk nation would come. The closest ones, they'd all come over here and harvest the berries. I went to Banff and parked at Juniper Hotel, and there was a Supilali bush right in front of me. And I told that the guy that works the yard there, and I told him, "You got some of our Suwapmuk brush here." And he says, "What's that?" And I said, "The Supilali." And he said, "Oh, the people around here look at it as a weed."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's one of our main staples here.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what they do is they gathered it and they mashed it up. And my grandmother was telling me they used a certain grass when they mashed the berries in it. It would cake, and they put it out in the sun and dry it and store it for the winter. And then in the winter time, they'd cut that cake of Supilali in part they wanted, how much they wanted to whip up. They used that grass in there as the beater.
Oh.
Yeah, and so it was some of the things that kind of stuck with me whenever I think about things.
So they'd be mashed up and then dried in a big cake with the grasses dried right in with it.
Yep.
And then the grasses were strong enough after that to use as a whisk?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, it dried right with it.
Yeah. I love talking about how far the Suwapmuk people roamed to do their hunting and gathering during the summertime. So can you tell us, we went all the way to the Rockies. How far north, south, or west did you go?
Well, like I said, Banff was the Alberta, because we do have a treaty with the Stoney to hunt in their area. And they're just outside of Banff there, in between Banff and Calgary. So we had a treaty with them, I think back in the late 1800s, somewhere around there. And so that's about as far we traveled, because there's pit houses up in that area. And Clearwater, way up there, well, that'll be north. And I think we went a little bit, because we got outside bands that kind of prevented us from going into their territory without creating a war. So our area runs right up to Williams Lake, Invermere, Enderby, and Cache Creek, I think, around Cache Creek in that area. Mm. So it was the other bands that were, that we didn't intrude in their area. We respected. I think you could get permission if you have asked politely if you could go into their territory. But half the time it means war if you intrude in their territory.
Mm.
Oh,
like the Sioux?
Yeah, yeah.
The Okanagan?
We've been arguing with them for centuries.
Yeah?
Yeah, and they, like a story in Enderby where they had that battle and that little mountain. Their version is the same as ours, because they won, and their version, they won. Because what I understand is that when they fought over there, the Suwapmus were in the valley a little there, and then they knew that the Silk were up in the hillside there. So they dressed up as women going out gathering, and they walked around and they came behind them and ambushed them. Now, when I told them about it, they said, no, they were the ones that dressed up as women. So it's been an ongoing argument with, you know, stories like that have been ongoing. Their version is a little different than ours, though.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is. So I think they tried. I think they tried getting along with the Suwapmuk back in the late 1800s. Because they started through marriage. Like, I'm part of it. My great-grandmother was Okanagan. I think they were trying to make peace with us.
Mm.
Because when my grandmother was born, she's the one that's part Okanagan. And back in the day, at that time, I think it was the mid-1800s, when my great-grandfather had a Suwapmuk wife, they didn't have any kids. So when the opportunity came for him to accept another one, was at Okanagan. I think they were trying to make peace with us then. So he had an Okanagan wife and a Suwapmuk wife. Because back in the day, multiple wives were the norm. It wasn't until the priest came when it was not allowed anymore. So when the priest came, they told the old Pierre-Yves, my great-grandfather, you're only allowed one wife. So he got rid of the Suwapmuk wife, because they didn't have any kids, so he kept the Okanagan one because they had kids. And Suwapmuk wife, because nobody would take her in after that because they're only allowed one wife. So she kind of willed herself to death. You know, she just went and she had nowhere to go and willed herself to death. And then wasn't long after the Okanagan wife was going across in a canoe at Shuswap. She had an epileptic fit and drowned, and my grandparents were, my grandmother was orphaned then, so there was a Dick family that raised them. So that's part of our history,
mm-hmm.
My mother's side. But yeah, back in the day, they had multiple wives. You know, if they could hunt and keep hunting and supporting a big family.
Yeah.
So there were multiple wives, and according to our culture, if your brother's wife died, you were made to take the brother's wife and as your own. See, everything wasn't all about sex. It was about looking after each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if it'd be really wife. In our culture, I don't think you were referred to as wives. But I think it was somebody to look after.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the way it was back in the day. So there's a lot of things that went on that was normal to us, but not very normal to the first settlers that came in.
Right. And the Catholic priests the black robes, as a lot of people here call them.
Well, according to Tate, you know what, when they first came over, they met them up north, and one of the early guides warned the Suwapmuk people, beware of the black robes. He said they're the coyote in disguise. He says they'll make you poor and needy if you listen to them. A lot of truth in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said once that your grandmother traded goods with people, some of the early settlers, just through a little tiny trading post.
Well, it wasn't really a trading post. When my grandmother moved into a log building, they couldn't build a pit house there because, remember, it's on bottom land and we'd have an indoor swimming pool every spring. So they had a log building down there and they had horses, cows, and a little garden. They had a root cellar. And they still kind of lived the old way, you know. They dried a lot of their berries and things like that, and they smoked their salmon, deer meat, moose meat, whatever game they had, and it all went into the root cellar. And when the early settlers came in, they were mostly Finlanders, moved up in the Glen Eden Bench, and they started trading with each other. Like our people started, they tried to make them become farmers, so they needed plows, they needed harness, they needed saddles, and so they'd work for the farmers and get work off whatever they traded with, and a lot of the trade was for food with the Finlanders. They came and traded for food, like the things that we didn't have was like sugar, salt, and all of that, so they traded. They'd come down to my grandmother's and she told them, go out in the root cellar, you know what you want. So they went in there and they took what they wanted, and then they left on a little table there, they left what they brought down. So there was a lot of trust in with them, you know, and there's a lot of exchanges between them. Now I think because a lot of our people end up and work for the farmers, you know, getting rid of the stumps and the trees and everything. So there was a lot of trading and a lot of communication going on back in the day. But once they got their farms all settled now, and I kind of think they kind of forgot about us, all the early settlers. That's when the good things like discrimination and all of that came into being. And I remind people, you know, that they're finally realizing, you know, we were the first people here. And we talk about truth and reconciliation, and I say, well, you know what, there's another part of truth and reconciliation that we have to do, and that's truth and reconciliation to the real first ones here, the animals. What are we doing to them? You know, they're all disappearing, and no more of us left in our ways with them are going to. No more salmon, no more deer, there are very little moose, so all the animals are slowly disappearing, so we got to talk about truth and reconciliation to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the plants, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when the early settlers were here, was that prior to the government's reserve system where they started to allocate a certain number of acres per settler, and then reserves were only a certain number of acres or 1 acre per person on, like, who are indigenous, who were here first?
Well, there was a land designation way back I think it was Douglas, was the one that started it. And they gave us acres and acres of land. And I think when the settlers came in, they realized that they gave us way too much, and so they started cutting it back, I think. And because I told that story in Many Faces of Mount Ida, about how our people lost some of the land. Even there's a story of my grandfather when they used to paddle their canoes always to Shuswap to visit their relatives over there. He used to stop at this one beach over at Sunny, over near the Narrows, probably around Margaret Falls, somewhere in there. They camp there every on their way to Chase. And he went there to camp one time, and apparently the owner chased him off. Mom was saying it's the first time she ever seen him cry, you know, because I think they started realizing, you know, that they are losing their land now. Their ways are disappearing. So I think those were the tears that he had of the disappearance of their ways, mm-hmm. you know. They couldn't go where they want, couldn't do what they want anymore. So all our hunting and gathering areas were kind of taken over. Settlement came in, so it was, I think, never really talked about it, but I think, you know, you probably see the loss in their eyes, you know, and I think they realized their ways are gone too. You know, how they've lived for centuries. And I maintain, too, you know, we talk about recession. I said, you know, we got enough land right across Canada to sustain us. When you think about it, it sustained our people for thousands of years. So why can't it do that the same for our people now? Mm-hmm. Anyways, it's just a thought.
That's a good thought, because pre-contact, the community populations here were, like, I know that, I remember reading that the Haida was a community of about 30,000 people. Yeah. Like all of the nations had thousands in yeah. their populations. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't as if it was only 300 or 600 members yeah. of each community. They were large populations, and it was yeah. sustainable to live here.
Yeah. Well, I heard some numbers like 10,000 up and down the, or right along the Thompson. Mm. That was pre-smallpox.
Yeah.
Smallpox and TB decimated our people quite a bit. Well, actually, they said they were 31 tribes here, Shuapung tribes, and now we're down to 17. So when smallpox came in, it really decimated a lot of our people. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, it was, there's a lot of, like you said, in the Truth and Reconciliation Report, there's a lot of truth that we all don't know, that settlers don't know, because we weren't taught in school. We were taught some history, but not the truth. It was the history of the victors, right? Okay, I'm going to keep on with this amazing conversation about the land. So you talked to us about why you don't go south, because of the Okanagan, and how far the territory goes west and north. Yeah. So it's quite a wide territory. Yeah. And so how would you get the food that you hunted and gathered from those places back here to Switzmalf? Like, did you use
You got to remember back in the day, there was way more water than we had here. Because you could canoe all the way up to Revelstoke.
Oh.
Because the story of Sinetqua, how she escaped from the tribe that kidnapped her up the Eagle River. And they had canoes, and they were taking her and her sister up towards Revelstoke, going up north.
Who took Sinetqua?
I think it might be the Dene or one of the tribes from up north.
Oh.
I think they raided our people My grandmother would say the only reason why they come down here is because our women were better looking. That was her story.
It's a good story.
She had a sense of humor. But yeah, they talked about her escaping from Dene or whoever it was, and took their canoe and all their weapons and came up, because her story is supposed to be posted on a rock wall over at the Narrows.
Oh.
And apparently she was a beautiful woman, and they warned her that she was going to be, might be kidnapped, and sure enough it did happen twice to her apparently. But that was quite a story. And so they're talking about canoes going up the Eagle River, so they must have went all the way up there, because now you look at it, it's just little creeks now, you know, you could almost walk all the way up there. And you know, so because the water must have been way deeper, because I remember them harpooning salmon up at Huppel, up towards Mabel Lake. They went out in their canoes and they harpooned them big Chinook salmon, and they were about 50, 60, 70 pounds. I was just a little young guy then, going with my grandparents up there, and they were harpooning salmon up there, and I was along. I guess that was part of my training too. They made a little spear for me, and I go along the riverbank, spearing leaves, sticks, and then trying to spear the little kokanee swimming along the shore there. I think it was part of my training to become a fisherman, which I did.
Yeah.
Became very adept at fishing in our Salmon River.
And the Salmon River here would have been much deeper then too, wider.
Oh yeah, they talked about canoes and that one too. They'd get come spear the fish and just throw them straight into the canoes and bring it down over to the shore, and they had smoke houses there for the salmon right away, and they smoked the salmon right down by the river there. It was a long time when they had a lot of salmon. It rivaled the sockeye run in Squilex.
Mm.
And I don't know, I think they said the dam or the slide at Hell's Gate interrupted the sockeye run up here.
Hmm.
We don't see any sockeye up here anymore. So
I remember a lot of the stories about this Salmon River used to be absolutely teeming with salmon, and no more. They don't come here.
No. We're lucky we get a couple of thousand going up there now. Hmm. And that's why we started the Salmon River Roundtable, was to protect our salmon. And there's no more salmon left, so can't protect something that's not there. Yeah.
Yeah. What other kinds of fish would have been in the rivers?
Oh, there was all different kinds. We had spring, coho, had sockeye, then we had suckers, different fish, you know. We always forget about those, suckers, squamfish. And there's even one we call chokochichi, it's a red mouth. I can't remember the names of all of the swap. Names for all of them, but we do have names for all of them in Swap Machine. So our people didn't just survive on salmon, they had other salmon fish to eat too, which they caught.
And there would be fishing in the lake too?
Oh yeah. There's stories of them spearing trout over at Engineers Point. In the fall time, they torched them over there, and they had torches on their canoe, and all of them were spawning, I guess. All the males would be circling the female, and they were told only spear a few of those smaller ones. They took a few salmon out of each one. It's to protect the species and, you know, to keep them going. So they only caught out a few, because apparently the males would circle the female. And they'd go over there, and then they kept just a few out of each one. More or less of a change of a diet, but I can't remember the name. It's a trout anyway that spawned in the fall. I forgot the name of it right now.
Hmm.
But they did catch, and then they caught ling cod during the winter months out in the lake. Because I remember skating out there and checking the lines for old Annie Cipri, and me and my brother would go out there and check the lines and ray out. He had about a dozen lines, fishing holes out there, and catch them during the winter months. So, squawfish, get the odd squawfish, but mostly it was ling cod.
So tell us about the smokehouses. You would have to build those each fall or each season when the salmon were running?
Yeah, well, I think the frames were up. You just had to gather. Sometimes the bulrushes would last long enough because they were walled with bulrushes. Because bulrushes was very important to our people because they made mats out of them and they used those for walls in the smokehouse. So the frames, usually the bulrushes will last. All you got to do is go in there and fill in the holes during the next year. But most of the time they stayed up fairly, they withstood the weather pretty good. And the reason why we smoke them is because we're not like the Fraser Canyon where there's so much heat and the sun dried their salmon. Our temperature here is too wet and damp, so we had to preserve our fish a different way. So smoking was the easiest, another alternative.
Mm-hmm. That must have been really hard to not just, eat the salmon as it's smoking. Like, it smells so good.
Well, we used it for trade. We traded a lot with the Okanagans and different. I think that's what the Fraser band that they traded with the coastal people and for their dentalia and their shells. Our people prized bright colored rocks or bright colored, the glass, especially when the glass beads came in. That really attracted, because a handful was worth one beaver pelt. And a lot of people, didn't you feel cheated? No, because we like the color. Oh, they talk about beaver pelts when the muskets first came out. Apparently, they stacked up the beaver pelt or fur pelt right up to as high as the musket was. That's how much the musket was worth.
Oh. So
somebody... that's what the story is now.
So was this area on the fur trade, that route that the settlers used?
Yeah.
So you had to kind of deal with trappers on your territory.
No, they bought it off us.
Oh.
And they had an outpost over at Pierce Point, that little old log building. It's gone now. And Kamloops was the main trading post at one time. So everybody went over there. My uncle was talking about catching muskrat always over to Kamloops. He said, those are the best muskrats going to Kamloops. So he'd trade over there too, and he was just a young guy. So a lot of trade went on. Well, that's where Salmon Arm is built on our trapping area, because this was all swamp at one time. Our people used to come over here and do a lot of trapping during the winter months. Till the highway came in and the railway kind of dammed it right up and did away with the swamps.
So what was here then? That would have been bulrushes?
Yeah, bulrushes. The usual lot of mink, beaver, you name it, all fur-bearing animals. I think it ran was always over to Piccadilly Mall. Downtown was all swamp.
So was the railway first, or was the highway first?
I think the railway came in, because I was looking at some of the early maps, and there were just trails back then, wagon roads.
And those wagon roads were built on your trails, right?
Pretty well, yeah, because we knew where to travel. That's like the main highway. That was our old trading trail a long time ago, always over to north. I told some guys were asking me, how did the Sugwapungs get up to Invermere? That was a long time ago. There was a chief, he had a favorite son. He fell in love with a woman up there. And they decided they were going to move back up there. The son, the chief didn't want to lose his favorite son, so he moved up there with them. That's how our people ended up there.
Hmm.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. A lot of people believing me, too. And, you know, everybody likes a good love story.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, interesting that the trade changed, like trading with other communities within Sohetmek territory changed with then selling, like trading for things that were brought in by settlers.
Yeah.
Like that, and then that stuff was used for, yeah, what, regalia? Or
yeah, regalia, mostly regalia, because our people loved color. And all pretty rocks and everything, so. But yeah, it was all for regalia, especially the trade with the coastal people, you know, the early ones. So I think it was, because when I went to Victoria and I was browsing through their archives, I came across the first duplex in BC for sure was in Lillooet. I guess their trade with the coastal people. They had pit houses up there too for their winter months. So, but I guess their trade with the coastal people, they seen their longhouses. So they built their pit houses square with a wall in between. So they had two families living in one pit house.
First duplex.
They call it the first duplex in BC.
Well, that's interesting, the influence of the longhouses here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because all our pit houses were circular,
mm-hmm,
you know. And it, when I talked, there was some Inu from Japan.
Mm.
They came down and talked to us, and they said they had pit houses too.
Mm.
But they had 8 posts on theirs. Ours is 4 because we looked at the 4 seasons, the 4... 4 was our magic number, whereas they had 8, and 8 was more sacred to them than our 4, so they doubled us. But yeah, there are a lot of similarities. They said they had the same problems because they were treated like we were treated, you know, when they people moved into the area and started doing the same thing they did to us, and they said that, you know, they were treated just like our native people here was treated. So there was a lot of similarities. And
Well, tell us more about the pit houses. So they would have been dug out.
Dug out.
In, like, how deep would they have been dug?
Below frost line.
Okay.
Yeah, and they had 4 main beams, and the walls were built around them, earth covered. And we argued with archaeologists for a while. They said my grandmother, actually she was just a young person, one of the last ones to live in one. And then you could still see the depression where it was just over in Chase. The depression is still there. And she remembers a little bit about it. So see, when we built the first one, she came and watched us. And I kind of think it was to her, it probably brought back a lot of memories when she was sitting on that old stump watching us building it. Because she was kind of mentoring us on how to build it. And she had a lot of fun with us, you know, enjoying us doing what we were doing, trying to live the old way or recreate the old way. So I think it brought back a lot of good memories for her.
Mm.
But she argued with the archaeologist. No such thing as a woman's entrance. Well, it wasn't really a woman's entrance. I think it was just an entrance. And they all seem to face towards the water. And it makes more sense, you know, because if you're packing water and if the coming down through the ladder on top, you know, it's pretty tricky, or hand bringing in firewood. So they had to have that separate entrance for them to come in through, bring in the water and the wood. And my grandmother said the only reason why women don't go up and down the ladder because Since a long time ago, our women never had underpants. Was there a Wetmore joke? But she still had a good sense of humor.
So there was an entrance in the top, in the center.
Yeah.
And there was a ladder that came down.
Yeah.
And then there was also an entrance that would be like at ground level.
Yeah.
And that would come down like...
Yeah, it'll go usually going out, and it's always at the bank of the river, because when it's raining or something, you know, the water wouldn't come into the pit house. It'd be towards the water, facing the water, going downhill kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So that way it wouldn't kind of flood. You can get a flash flood, you know.
So then what would the inside look like?
It was walled. Some say they... People used logs. Our people used cedar bark to line it, the walls in, and they left a little area up on top, and that's where that was their closet, cupboard closet. They stored all their clothing, blankets, and everything up there on the ledge.
Oh, yeah.
And their food, their baskets, all of that. So that was all part of their old way of living. And
how would the heating work? How would the fire work?
Well, they had a pit right in the middle. And what they did was they heated some bigger rocks. Then when they're ready to go to bed, or, you know, when it got dark, they rolled the rocks in there. So all they needed was just a small fire to keep those rocks warm. So it kept the place pretty cozy and warm all evening long. So,
And this is what... So you would, the pit houses were lived in seasonally or year-round?
Yeah, all winter.
All winter.
Just the winter months. Remember, that's why they called us half-naked people. We went out hunting and gathering then.
So who in the group went on these long excursions to go hunting
and gathering? The whole family.
Everybody went?
Yeah, whole family.
So what did they sleep in when they were out on the land?
Well, they built a... tents, kind of, out of tules.
Oh.
The round reed.
Mm-hmm.
They sewed them together with a long stick on each side. And they're about 4 to 6 feet long. They have mats about 4 feet, 6 feet wide. They rolled them up. It's just like a tent, you know, a traveling tent. They could roll it up, and it's light and portable.
Yeah.
And all they did was built their lean-to or teepee style, mostly lean-tos. They used those to cover it. And that was their tent during the summer months.
Hmm.
They could even build canoes out of them.
Out of the tule?
Yeah.
Oh.
I didn't believe it until I seen a picture of it. They had one and they... I think in Tate's book, or one of them anyway, but I came across it. And that's when I think it was in the museum in Victoria, the provincial, I seen a picture of it. So then I was going through the old, that old magazine, the one that traveled the world over.
National Geographic?
Yeah, there was in South America. They had a guy coming down the river with a tule raft.
Oh.
He was sitting on it and he had a llama with him. They were coming down the river rapid, so on a tule raft. Then I seen an article on the one of the, I guess maybe National Geographic had a film, their TV. They had an old fisherman out there. He had a tule canoe, and he's making his own nets, and he's throwing it out in the ocean, fishing with it. So then I realized, you know, all our native people, you know, it's, you know, we shouldn't be called a Swapmakula, you know. I was saying, you know, maybe we should be calling it Kalmakula, land of the people. So when you think about it, the natives from right up north, right down to the tip of South America, that's all land of the people, you know, because we're, when we went to Smithsonian in Washington. We built a pit house over there, and their theme, Smithsonian theme, was Native Housing of North America. And we were the only Canadians there. But when I looked at all the their housing, there was a lot of similarities, you know, with the, all their housing, because they used what was at hand, just like what they had to use at hand when we went down there, because they didn't have the same kind of stuff that we had. They had to utilize, because when we had to go down there and build it, I was on the phone two, three times a week explaining what we needed. So they had to phone Smithsonian, and Smithsonian had to find something similar to it.
Mm.
So when we got there to build it, you know, it was all prefabbed already, so we just had to put it together.
So what were these materials? What did they have to collect?
Well, we had logs for the main beams, and I don't know what kind of logs. I never really thought about it. We were busy putting it together.
Yeah.
And I can think they had some kind of a bark they covered it over with, because we used cedar bark,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the walls and then for the roof. And I can't remember what it was now. It was about 40 years ago when we did that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it was an experience.
Is it still there?
No. Yeah. Because it was just their theme, and they got that parked for different things every, you know, just a temporary 1 year thing. So.
Hmm. Well, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Because how long would a pit house normally last once you've built it?
I think it lasts about underground homes, close to 50 to 100 years.
So it would do several generations of family before you'd have to build a new one.
Well, my mother, I was supposed to build the one in Kamloops at the residential school there. They built 4, I think, over there. And I couldn't go. Something else came up, and I couldn't go. So my mother went to be the consultant. And about 5, 6 years later, they were wondering how come the law, you know, it was kind of falling apart. And to them, you got to remember, back in the day, our people lived in them. You know, with the heat from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
It would kind of made the logs a little, kept it drier. You know, no rot would sit into the logs.
Right.
So it would last a heck of a lot longer if somebody was living in them, but, you know, just deteriorating because, you know, nobody's in it all winter long.
Yeah.
So that's the reason. So it would last, I think, pretty close to 100 years.
Hmm. And I just want to make clear, too, your mother is the elder late Dr. Mary Thomas.
Yeah.
Quite famous in this area for her incredible ethnobotany work.
Mm-hmm.
And was interviewed many times, wrote books, an incredible breadth of plant knowledge that she passed on to many people.
Yeah.
She was a pretty incredible human.
Yeah. Well, we worked together as a team. You know, we had a lot of fun together. And we had a lot of road trips, especially when Ursula said, "Oh, the one time we went fishing with Ursula Surtees, the curator from Kelowna, that we were doing a book on salmon fishing with Suwapmuk. We took her down the river and we were torching salmon. After we finished torching the salmon, we caught 3, I think, that night. We built a fire and Mom opened them up and cooked it right by the fire so they had fresh salmon that evening. And as we were sitting there, we told them it was illegal for us to be fishing because they had it closed. You should have seen that every time they heard a little noise, they'd be heading to swivel around and start looking to see if it was a fish warden coming. But it was quite an experience. They took they done a little booklet in Lough Lochay. And so it was, we done one on pit housing of peep Suwapmuk fishing. I think we've done 4 booklets with them. And I built a pit house for them at the museum in Kelowna. So Yeah, they, one of the first people that recognized us for who we were. And I'm kind of glad of it because I was pretty well an alcoholic when I, in my younger years. But once I started getting it, just like Mother, you know, once I started getting into the culture, the less we thought about the alcoholism. So I think I have that too. Part of my life is to be thankful for.
So you were part of the road show that she was on, and you were just a little bit more behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And then...
because she was gifted. She could make you cry, make you laugh, anything. She said, you know, yeah, I don't think I'll ever have that quality. I struggle with it now because nobody else will do it, so I'm kind of stuck with it. I do my best.
I think that you're doing a wonderful job, Louis, because you've built bridges in this area that nobody could have done. You learned from your mother, and you are doing a beautiful job.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to do it.
And this show, this radio show, is one of those things, right? One of the things that you're doing that helps people build an understanding of Sequoia mm-hmm. culture, and maybe even helps other people learn important land-based values.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for today. We're going to wrap up today's show, but I look forward to our next conversation on Saha'aya.
Okay. I'd like to thank the radio station for giving us some time here.
Cook's Gem, everybody. See you next time.